The concept of fecal microbiota transplantation, or FMT, as we call it for short, is to actually approach the recurrent C. difficile problem in a completely different way. So the goal is actually not necessarily to say you're going to test negative for C. difficile after we do this procedure. Some people will continue to have C. difficile within their bowel and carry it. But the idea is to get the rest of the system healthier, in a healthier position, so that the C. difficile is not causing symptoms or disease. And it's done by getting stool from a healthy screen donor and administering it to somebody who seems to have one of these issues, where the microbiota and the intestines are just not diverse enough.
Welcome to the Living Transplant Podcast, where we take you behind the scenes of the transplant program at Toronto General Hospital. I'm your host, Candace. Each episode, we share the powerful stories of transplant recipients and living donors, along with insights and education from leading medical professionals. Today, we're exploring a topic that might surprise you, the gut. Specifically, how a groundbreaking treatment called fecal microbiota transplantation, or FMT, is changing lives for people living with recurrent C. difficile infections. Joining me is Dr. Susie Hoda, Division Head of Infectious Diseases at the University Health Network and Sinai Health, and one of Canada's leading experts in infection prevention and control. From preparing hospitals for the COVID-19 pandemic to pioneering innovation treatments that restore the body's natural balance, Dr. Hoda shares how the smallest organisms can teach us the biggest lessons about resilience, collaboration, and hope. Please enjoy. It's my absolute honor and thrill to have Dr. Susie Hoda with me today. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me. I'm very excited to be here.
And for our listeners, can you introduce yourself?
Sure. So I am an infectious diseases physician, and currently I'm the division head for our infectious diseases program at University Health Network and Sinai Health. And I'm also the medical director for infection prevention and control at the University Health Network.
Amazing. So can you speak to me a little bit about this line of work? I mean, it's very unique. And what interested you about that? How did you get into this line of work?
Yeah, I mean, I think from early days, I was always a little fascinated with infectious diseases because it's so diverse. And, you know, the microbes out there always seem to outsmart us humans. And so I did end up doing my undergraduate degree in microbiology and immunology when I was in university. And I learned in my fourth year that it was more the impacts of these infectious diseases than the mechanisms of how they worked that spoke to me. So that led me to doing medicine. And through my residency, I just loved ID because it's such a diverse profession. You could work in travel and tropical medicine, or you could do HIV care, or you could have a public health type role. And it's, you know, like I said, very cognitive. So it's a lot of problem solving. And as I progressed through it, I realized the big picture was what I really enjoyed being a part of, things like managing outbreaks or other systems responses. And that's what really led me to infection prevention and control, because it's a very collaborative, sort of big picture systems-based role.
Amazing. And I mean, you talk a little bit about that, and I've said this to many people when we broach that topic of COVID or, you know, any kind of crisis in the past, we could do an entire season on it, really, because it's so vast and so huge. And like you said, there's so many working pieces with that. But I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about how you prepared UHN for the COVID pandemic. How did you work with the team and prepare the hospital for that?
I think we're naturally set up to do some of that in infection prevention and control, because even our day-to-day work is very collaborative. We're always working with, as I put it, every corner of the hospital. So, you know, from the support services workers to the, you know, the folks who are doing the clinical decision-making to other sort of corporate teams. And so there's that aspect of the work that kind of it helped in the time of crisis. You knew who to go out to.
Right.
But the other part of it is pandemic preparedness has always been an interest of mine, academically and just professionally. So I was already somewhat familiar with the kinds of things you need to think about in the early stages of a pandemic. And then as it
Right.
progresses over, I had a bit of a dry run with the H1N1 influenza pandemic in 2009 and 2010. And that helped as well, just understanding and reminding myself how I took each step forward. But what was really different this time is, in the past, I was the junior colleague and I had my more seasoned colleagues to help guide the way or lead the way in that case. And this time around, we were it. Like my
Right.
cohort of specialists in this area were really helping to make most of the decisions around how to respond from an IPAC perspective or an infectious diseases perspective. And so I found myself drawn into many meetings and group sort of sessions with external colleagues, and worked very closely with Ontario Health and Public Health Ontario and Toronto Public Health Agency of Canada, which was really great work. And it was really enjoyable. And it also confirmed to me something that I had learned early on in my job, and that's that relationships are everything. And that connectedness and the relationships are also important because you got to be able to take the pulse of the people around you on that decision making, because sometimes we don't have science to guide our decisions. We have to rely on what's the risk tolerance, how feasible is this, how acceptable would it be for people to actually do this.
Yeah, that's huge. And thinking about how it all rolled out and how much fear was in the air with everyone. I'm a transplant recipient myself, and I've talked about it before, how scary it really was for those of us in that community and anyone who was, everybody was afraid at the beginning of the outbreak. And then slowly hearing more about the research and learning about how teams like yours were dealing with it and how there were people in place to keep us safe and to help guide us. And the research that that Dr. Kumar was doing in transplant recipients and having the vaccines and how it all came to be, it's pretty fascinating. And when that hit, it was an instant fear for a lot of us. How do you move through that fear and really use your logic and your team and everything to take control over it? I think for a lot of us, we heard about what was happening and kind of ran into our holes and waited for those people like you to take care of us and tell us what to do next.
Yeah, you do have that choice, right? At that moment, do I want to run into my hole or do I want to face it head on and try and be part of the solution? And I think being a very goal-oriented person, but also seeing a real purpose, that makes such a big difference. If you see where you can help and what your purpose in this, horrible event that's affecting people's lives immensely, it really does help you keep going. But you can only do that for so long unless you have a good supportive network. So again, it comes back down to relationships, why it's everything. But having a great team here in the Infection Prevention and Control Department and knowing my physician colleagues as well, we're always there and willing to step up and, cover the infectious diseases service such that myself and colleagues of mine who are also in infection prevention and control could take a step back and focus on the administrative work and the guidance development and the communications and all that, while the clinical infectious diseases service at seeing the patients who have other infections in the hospital, et cetera, was taken care of. So just knowing you have those kinds of backups and the support of people, it made such a difference.
Amazing. So we're going to shift gears a little bit, away from COVID and that type of thing, even though it's fascinating to me that you're in this role. But thinking about in the infectious disease side, I'm wondering if we can move into talking about C. difficile, and we'll talk a little bit about fecal transplants. Normally on this podcast, I was saying we talk about solid organs. So it's really interesting that I get to have this chance to dive into this. But for people who don't know what C. diff is and how it affects the body, can you talk to us a little bit about that?
Sure. So C. difficile is a bacterium that can enter into your body, usually through either your hands becoming contaminated with the organism or spores from the organism and then ingesting it, or through food or other substances that you're ingesting that could be contaminated. And once it gets into your large intestine, it can just hang out there, and about 5 to 10% of people just carry this organism. And it establishes itself alongside all the millions of microbes that that are already present there in your colon and are naturally there to perform important tasks in our body. The problem is this organism can be triggered under certain circumstances to actually cause disease. And when it does, it causes a colitis through the release of toxins that will inflame your bowel wall. And when you get this kind of colitis, you can have terrible diarrhea. You can have bad abdominal pain, you can have fevers, you can have nausea, vomiting, lose your appetite, and lose some weight. And in a very small proportion of people, about 3% or so of people who get this infection, they can actually become critically ill and end up requiring some of their colon to be taken out or even die from it. So it's a small minority that get that sick, but it's a big consequence. But what we do find is actually becoming one of the biggest impacts of this kind of infection is the fact that it can recur. So you might get better after one episode of it and treatment for that episode, but down the road it might actually come back. And then that ends up really becoming a bit of a chronic issue for people.
Interesting. And thinking about that, I actually had C. diff last year. I was not in hospital when I acquired it. I'm wondering, is this still like, I think in the past we used to think you got it in hospital. Is that still what we think? Like, is C. diff still a hospital acquired infection, or can we get this anywhere?
That is such an excellent question because it is considered a healthcare associated infection. We do surveillance as though it's a healthcare associated infection. But what's challenging about this is you don't really know that when that first step occurs, when people acquire the organism into their system, because of this whole issue of being a carrier for, a period of time, we don't know when people actually picked it up. And then what we do know is that the infection symptoms can be triggered by things like antibiotic exposures very frequently, or changes in your own health and overall well-being. The people who tend to get C. difficile infection now and who come to my clinic with recurrent C. difficile infection are actually much more diverse in terms of, how their exposures may have actually gotten them to that place. Some did have frequent hospitalizations. You do still see that. But others are community dwelling, even young people who don't seem to visit healthcare that often. So I think there are reservoirs out there that have, kind of left into the community that may involve our food sources and other things, pets as well. We know some domestic dogs, for example, can carry human strains of C. difficile that are introducing it into people. But ultimately, there are some specific risk factors like age, if your immune system is suppressed, if you have underlying bowel pathology, so changes to your gastrointestinal tract or inflammatory bowel disease, there are different risk factors that are probably starting to come onto the forefront.
Interesting. And so once you do acquire C. diff, what was the general treatment? Or let's say for somebody like me who it's not reoccurring, it's been a one-off that it happened, how is that treated for people?
So in general, an episode of C. difficile is treated with antibiotics that are directed against the organism. So you can be treated with antibiotics and get better. The issue is that one of the problems with C. difficile is we believe that you can get this and have recurrences of C. difficile because you don't have a diverse enough intestinal microbiota. And the intestinal microbiota is a whole community of organisms, microorganisms that live within your colon, in this case, that perform other functions with human health. And when it is not able to keep that C. difficile in check through the right constitution, diversity, we don't really know exactly the mechanisms. It could be a combination of things. That's when it's allowed to actually cause disease. So you can imagine that our treatments for C. difficile are antibiotics, which, although they help against the C. difficile, also wipe out some of your intestinal flora. And
Right.
so there is a bit of a conflict, I guess, already set up with how we treat C. difficile infection that puts you potentially at risk for there being a recurrence.
Interesting. Okay. So someone who has frequent reoccurrences, who's dealing with this on a long-term basis and it's really impacting their lives. I've been reading about fecal transplantation. So I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about what that is and kind of discuss who would be eligible for that.
Absolutely. And I think before I do that, you did touch on something that's really important. That's the impact of recurrent C. difficile infection on people's lives. And I have a clinic that's pretty much dedicated to that. So I've seen people and heard their accounts for a long time. This is a disease that has kept people at home, and isolated because they are afraid to leave the home. Because they might have symptoms while they're en route somewhere. They're afraid they're going to give it to somebody else. And especially their loved ones. It's had a huge impact, I think, on the mental health and the overall health of people who suffer from this without it, getting under control, losing weight, having, malnourishment, essentially. It's a bigger problem than I think when I was, a trainee hearing about it the first time I ever appreciated. So yeah, the concept of fecal microbiota transplantation, or FMT, as we call it for short, is to actually approach the recurrent C. difficile problem in a completely different way. So rather than thinking about trying to eliminate the organism through, giving antibiotics to kill it off, et cetera, the approach is to try and repopulate the intestinal microbiota with whatever substances are helpful to keep it in check again. So the goal is actually not necessarily to say you're going to test negative for C. difficile after we do this procedure. Some people will continue to have C. difficile within their bowel and carry it. But the idea is to get the rest of the system healthier, in a healthier position, so that the C. difficile is not causing symptoms or disease. And it's done by getting stool from a healthy screen donor and administering it to somebody who seems to have one of these issues, where the microbiota and the intestines are just not diverse enough.
Interesting. So you mentioned that word there, donor. So who would a suitable donor be?
It's a great question because I could go on and on about all the things that we look for in donors, but essentially it boils down to you want the healthiest of the healthy. And so this would be somebody with no health conditions that have been diagnosed at least. And we even look at family history and first degree relatives of specific types of conditions, health conditions, things like significant mental health conditions, things like that, because we don't really know how much of these things are passed over potentially through genetics, but also, through shared environments. And then we have a very rigorous screening process to ensure that we reduce the risk of infection transmission. And a lot of that focus of the donors is around reducing infection transmission through the donor stools. And that involves screening for not just the presence of, but risk factors for acquiring. Things like bloodborne pathogens, HIV virus, hepatitis viruses, things like that, as well as common enteric or gut pathogens, that would be bacterial, viral, et cetera, parasitic infections. And then finally, for sexually transmitted infections. And through, COVID-19 and all this other, we've had to adjust our screening to ensure we're keeping as up to date on emerging pathogens. We also look for antibiotic-resistant organisms, bacteria that these folks may carry without having any symptoms, mostly because we don't want those to spread around in general. And somebody who gets an FMT with, stool that would carry one of these could potentially develop an infection later, with one of these more resistant, hard-to-treat organisms.
Yeah, this is all incredibly fascinating, thinking about these donors. And I'm wondering, you talk about all of these criteria to have a donor for somebody and what could be transferred with that FMT. I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about that, whole body effect of swapping microbiomes. And, I've read some papers about how some of these phenotypes can be transferred via this FMT. But I'm wondering if there's any more research into like what those are. So one of the papers discussed obesity as one, how that could impact somebody. Could it be also not just like physical things that could be transferred? Like you talked about mental health screening and things like that as well. So I know that's a huge question. I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, absolutely. There has been such an explosion of research on the intestinal microbiota as well as FMT as a procedure, as an intervention related to other health conditions. And like, I think it's a table of probably 30 different things that are postulated as being potentially related to your gut microbiome. And so there's been so many clinical trials and just even case reports that you find out there that question, is there an association between FMT and your metabolic health or other gastrointestinal illnesses or mental health problems, things like depression and anxiety, because we know there is a connection between the gut and the central nervous system. There is that access. So, it's hard to summarize all of it, but what I will say is we don't, everything is quite preliminary, I think, in other health conditions outside of C. difficile infection, where we've had far more research and more time to accumulate the experience. But I think that this field is going to change, over the next the 15 years, we're going to know so much more about it and how it can be applied in different ways. And hopefully we'll learn a little bit more about the different mechanisms in which, these transfers of microbiota actually impact on these different health conditions. And it's likely to be different ways because such a complicated environment. I mean, when you think about it, the intestinal microbiome is kind of an organ on its own. And we don't really consider it that, but it is. If it has many functions and through various ways, and we just really need to understand that better. We are very interested in understanding how this also affects their health in other ways. So we do have a long-term follow-up study that is part of our program. It's observational, and people who consent to being part of that are followed before and at various time points up to 3 years out from their FMT. And we have specific questionnaires, and we take blood and stool samples to answer a couple of predefined outcomes that we are interested in following over time in our cohort of people. But also it provides us the ability that if a question arises later, we can actually, go back and find out if there's an association or a risk or something else that's associated with the FMTs.
Interesting. So thinking about those recipients in that 3 year process, for patients who had C. diff and then they received an FMT, what was their health like prior to that? And how have they responded and how has that changed their lives post-transplant?
Yeah, I think I spoke about some of the impacts on people's personal lives and just how they live their lives and how they feel. I mean, people with recurrent C. difficile infection during the episodes that they have, as well as, following those episodes, can feel incredibly weak, fatigued. Like I said, they can lose their appetite and lose a lot of weight from that. And so, there are ways to manage that prior to, and we want people to be in the best kind of state as possible before we go ahead with the FMT, just to try and improve their outcome overall. But what we do see is after someone's been successful with an FMT, it can be a complete life changer. And, I've had patients say, I started to feel better almost instantly, which I think is maybe a little bit biased, but very shortly after receiving the series of FMT, just overall feeling so much better and, not having to worry about the diarrhea and about the abdominal pains and all of that has been such a relief for a lot of them. It isn't 100% effective though. It's about 80 to 85% effective. And I think the people who do not as well are the more medically complex people who come in with other forms a colitis along with their recurrent C. difficile infection, or have many other, organ failure issues or other complexities to what's happening with their health overall. In which case, we do have to have a very frank conversation. This may be worthwhile going through just to, get the C. difficile issue under control, but it's not going to solve all your problems. And some people do, have the hope that FMT, because the intestinal microbiome is such a mystery in terms of how it affects your health, that going ahead with FMT will also help with other things. And there's no guarantee that that's going to happen.
I know for myself personally, and a lot of the transplant recipients that I've talked to have echoed what you said about, almost instantly feeling better though. So, having that change in your life, whether it's an organ transplant or FMT, or we've talked about ocular stem cells as well, all the recipients that I talk to say just knowing that it's happened, knowing that, there's a chance of that hope that it's going to cure all of these symptoms and give us a chance to now have the life that I'm supposed to be living and have this healthier life. And like you said, that word hope, we always think about what's next and, could this be used for other things? And many of the people who I talked to prior to this interview, they said to me, well, can it treat other things? Like, could it be maybe not a cure, but a treatment for IBS or, other things that impact people's guts and even, it may be way out there, but I also had read an article about a woman who had an FMT from her mother and was all of a sudden started gaining weight, and they couldn't understand how that connection. Her mother was obese and she had received this FMT. And so there's all these really strange things out there talking about, like you said, we don't really know quite the full spectrum of how these things impact. But I'm wondering if there's ever been a thought to treating issues like IBS or obesity with an FMT.
I think there's always potential. There have been many studies considered or started looking at these different conditions, some of the ones that you've mentioned. The obesity one's really interesting because I think that there is an understanding that your intestinal microbiota is involved in metabolic health. Absolutely. So you can think of how there would be a mechanism for that to actually play a role. But I think that one case that you talked about got a lot of press and it
It
hasn't been
did.
replicated in the same way. So it's an interesting sort of hypothesis generating piece of information, but it's definitely not definitive. But this is why the research has exploded in this field. And our program, where for clinical care, we provide FMT for patients with recurrent C. difficile infections. That's because it's the only approved indication through Health Canada. And in terms of treatment guidelines, that actually uses FMT. But all these other areas have to be under sort of the auspices of research. And our program does support research in that kind of way because we know how complicated it is to set up an FMT program. And we've been through the process and understand what it takes to get a research study approved. So if there's anything we can do to facilitate it for other people, why reinvent the wheel? So we have had some other studies that have been supported by our program here at UHN Sinai. And I think that's what we need. We need to have more research, different health conditions, but also research into the process of FMT itself. So the mechanisms, the methodologies, how do we optimize it so that we're actually giving people the best treatment possible for whatever condition they have. And we're still in the infancy of that kind of research.
Interesting. That's always exciting, right? When you're kind of at the beginning of something and finding all of these new amazing things. But I think, if you told somebody that they had an 85% chance of winning $1 million, that would be a pretty fantastic stat to have, right? To go into it. So we talked about the positive things about FMT and treating C. diff. I'm wondering if there's any side effects to an FMT that would impact somebody.
There are definitely risks associated with it because it's like any other procedure. And it does depend a little bit on how you're actually delivering the FMT to the recipient. There are four ways to do so. There's the enema route, where you put an enema catheter or have a syringe and push the material in. There's also putting a tube in through the nose and into the upper part of the small intestine and infusing the FMT that way. You can give it by colonoscopy, and you can also give oral capsules, so by mouth. And those capsules are manufactured within a lab and basically contain the matter that you want to get there. There are pros and cons to each of them, and different programs really kind of work with what they're most familiar and comfortable with. So there isn't a standard out there that says you should be doing this first and whatnot. At our program, we offer it by enema route. And so there is the possibility of some procedure-related risks. And that's the first category that I talk to patients about, putting a catheter into the rectum. If there is weakening of the bowel walls, there is a small, at least theoretical risk of there being a perforation, which is when you get a tear of the bowel wall and you can get a serious abdominal infection for that from that. So I've not seen this documented, but it is a theoretical risk that I do let people know about. The other thing is you're giving a load of bacteria and other microbes into the body. I mean, albeit into a part of the body that's accustomed to seeing a lot of microbes, but there is a possibility that some of those bacteria can escape into the bloodstream. It's a process called translocation, and it can happen from a procedure like this. And the risk is slightly larger when somebody's immune suppressed. So we do talk about that in more detail when I do have patients who are immune suppressed. So those are the main procedure-related risks. Otherwise, it's very well tolerated as a procedure. But the next category of risk is around the donors. And I did talk about, the ideal donor. We have a very stringent process for screening our donors. However, you can't detect everything. And, there is trust involved in your donor screening as well. Trust that people are going to be truthful and that they're able to remember everything that they need to tell you about if they arise over time, because most of our programs that have donors have what we call universal donors. In other words, you find someone who's passed all of your rigorous screening up front, and then you keep them in the program and have them donate regularly, and you keep rescreening them to ensure it's safe over that time. But also, we can't test for everything. And we can't test for things we don't know about yet. And so there is always going to be a little bit of inherent risk with a program that relies on, human products to actually do a treatment. And the final category of risk that I've talked to people about is really around these unknown other health effects of manipulating your gut microbes. So we don't know if this is going to change your risk of diabetes in the future. And, for an 89-year-old person who just really wants better quality of life, that may not be an important factor in their decision making. But a 30-year-old who has young children at home and, has their whole life in front of them, that's a really important thing to think about, is you're accepting a treatment with some uncertainty. It will really help you with this issue, I believe, given what you've told me. However, this is a potential risk.
Interesting. And then long term, thinking, you follow these people for about 3 years. Do people need another transplant, or, if it's deemed that this has taken control of the symptoms of C. diff, is that kind of it for them, or do they need to take medication similar to a solid organ transplant recipient? Like, what does that long-term lifestyle, I guess, look like post FMT?
It's actually a really good question. And even though we try to keep our patients, at least for the first 3 years, in follow-up, beyond that, there's obviously going to be drop-off. And some of understanding those really long-term effects relies upon patients getting re-referred to you because they do drop off the radar. So to be honest, I can't tell you 15 years after having received a transplant what every one of my patients' outcomes has been overall with their life. But what I can say is that in that first 3 years, it's really valuable to be following people. And I think these programs need to, anyone who's doing an FMT needs to follow people up and have that connection. And it's something that again, there's not a lot of standard around. So that is important.
Interesting. So then lastly, I guess thinking about, everything you've talked about today and how exciting it is to think about, the change for people, because that's what we like to focus on, especially on this podcast as well, that it's just so hopeful and joyful to know that there's this chance for people to have that like renewal of feeling good in their day-to-day lives. And so I'm wondering, what do you see for the future of FMT and for the patients that you treat? And if there's anything you would like to tell your patients or, people who are living with C. diff, any final thoughts, I guess.
Yeah, so I think starting with people who are living with C. difficile, especially recurrent C. difficile infection, just having them understand that there is hope out there for a way to manage it. And even if the FMT is not successful or not something you're able to go ahead with for whatever reason, there are ways to manage the disease so it doesn't take over your life. That's the first thing I want to see, because I see some very hopeless people come in. You know,
Right,
they feel like their lives have been ruined forever and there's nothing that can be done. So there is hope. The second thing in terms of the future of FMT, I think in the more immediate future, what we need is funded programs. So at this time, our program is mostly funded through in-kind contributions of our hospitals as well as research. And it's supporting clinical care, which we've integrated into a research study. It really is something that all Canadians need to have access to if they need it. Thankfully, it's not that frequent that people would need it, or not that many people who would need it, but it should be something we can access. So I think that's something that needs to be worked on. And then the final part about, you know, the future of FMT is there are commercial products that have come onto the market in the US and that are being looked at, I think, in Canada. And this would be preparations that you could use instead of having to run your whole donor FMT program. So find the donors and screen them rigorously, like I mentioned, and maintain that relationship and all that. That part of our FMT program is probably the most complicated part of it. And it's expensive and time consuming. And I think over time, we're going to see some of these products come onto the market. And I think, you know, it'll be the onus is on us as clinicians to make sure we're using them appropriately. But I think that could have a positive effect on access to FMT, potentially.
Amazing. Well, it's all incredibly fascinating and exciting to hear about. So thank you so much for taking time with us today and for explaining all of this and of course for all of the amazing work you do, because all of that passion and that hard work that you put into it really is impacting people's lives. And we're so grateful to have people like you who are, championing taking care of people that we may not think about often, or we may not hear enough about. So thank you for all that you do.
Well, thank you for having me.
Thank you so much. We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Living Transplant Podcast. If you did, please rate, leave us a review, and share with your friends. Don't forget to subscribe to Living Transplant wherever you're listening today. If you have any ideas for podcast episodes, please reach out to us at livingorgandonation@uhn.ca. For information about living organ donation, you can visit us at www.livingorgandonation.ca. Special thanks to Bespoke Productions for editing this episode and for production support. I'm your host, Candace Coughlin. Thanks for spending your time with us.